Okay, this is the hour. We'll take your phone calls with Robert Zubrin. You talk about us going into space. This program has been moving at a rocket ship pace. So we'll do that when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Robert, so we were right in the tail end of talking about getting a human being to be comfortable to go to Mars for 6 months, stay a year and a half, come back in 6 months as well. Realistically, if we went to Mars with men or women, when could we do that?
Well, I think that if we had a real decision, if President Obama was to get up tomorrow and announce with the same degree of commitment
that Kennedy did,
right, in 1961, we could be on Mars by the end of this decade. From a technical point of view, we're much better prepared today to send humans to Mars than we were to send men to the moon in 1961, and we would
Absolutely.
Have 8 years later.
Absolutely. I mean, we've got new technology. You imagine the technology they had then.
They didn't even have push-button telephones.
No, nothing. Nothing. Buzz Aldrin used his pen to launch off the surface of the moon. He had to put it in there, remember?
Mm-hmm.
Just amazing. Amazing. But I don't know. Do you think we should just bypass the moon and go straight to Mars?
Yes, I do. The reason is this, is that, you know, people can think of reasons why you might want to go back to the moon first, or you might want to do various other things first. In fact, there's an infinite number of things you can think of that you might want to do first. But if you actually want to go to Mars, you have to go to Mars. And if we go around thinking of intermediate activities, we'll just never get there.
That's true. All right, let's go to the phones. Tom in Port Angeles, Washington. You're up with Robert Zubrin on Coast to Coast, Tom. Go ahead.
Howdy, George. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
The, about you know, humans living in confinement and working there. You know, we've been doing this since World War One on submarines, and we run nuclear submarines now, and we do 8 months and year and a half tours if we have to. And that's 80 guys in a 400-foot tube, all right? As far as getting to Mars, we've always had the capability to do that since we built the shuttles. And now that they're retired, we need to put about six nodes between them, get some sun shields on them, get them stocked up, right? Spin them so that they have artificial gravity to work with, right? Navigate them to Mars and land them there. It's pretty straightforward. We've always been able to do it. Why haven't we done it? It's not going to take another decade. It could have been done as soon as we decided to retire them.
Well, I basically agree with you, and the point about the submarines is good. And, of course, the submarines that we used to have were a lot smaller than the current subs, the subs we had in World War II, for example. And the German subs in World War II were even smaller still. So that's a very good example, and I'm glad you brought it up. We basically have the capability to launch people to Mars. There's a few things, hardware elements you have to build. You got to build the landing system. You know, there's engineering to be done, but it's not like Los Alamos 1943, where we're venturing into unknown realms of new physics. This is just doing a kind of engineering that we know how to do, but doing it right, doing the right craftsmanship, the right engineering, not making mistakes. But there's nothing in it that's beyond us. It's a question of leadership.
I would assume we're going to do some, if we send a man to Mars, we're going to do some flybys.
Well, once again, okay. Now, by the way, we won't send a single person. We'll send a crew, probably four or five people. I would not do. It would not be my choice to do a flyby mission. If you're going to go all the way to Mars,
just
you might
do
as
it.
Well land on Mars.
I agree.
And also, you know, the place where you get, for instance, the cosmic ray dose is while you're in transit. And not while you're on Mars. On Mars, you get a much lower dose because, first of all, you have the planet under you that blocks out half of space. You have some atmosphere. You can throw sandbags on the roof of your hab. You have all the mass you need to shield yourself, but in space. So the idea here is to go to Mars. And once again, not to think, you know, people come up with these things. They say, well, let's go to the moon. Let's go to asteroids. Let's go to Phobos. Let's go to Deimos. Let's do flyby missions. Let's go to Lagrange points. I mean, there's just any number of these things that people can come up with that each have a certain logic. But if you, unless you say, what is the minimum number of things we can do to get to Mars, you never get there.
All right, let's go to Todd in Las Vegas, Nevada. First-time caller. Hi, Todd. Go ahead.
George, Dr. Zubrin, it's an honor speaking to both of you, and I'm a Lagrange point guy. I think that Mars is so far away that it can't be connected to our economy. 3 years away, and then you've got a different gravity to deal with. If our focus were on something closer, around the cislunar space, around the moon, then you're dealing with something where you can go as a student on vacation, retirees can visit, you have the entire spectrum of economic activity. And I think that's just a much more practical thing to do. What do you think about that, Dr. Zubrin?
Well,
I'm a Gerard O'Neill space colony guy.
Right. I don't agree, except for one thing, which I'll come back to. But first, I'll explain the part where I disagree.
Okay.
To build an O'Neill space colony, you're talking about fabricating something with a mass of like a billion tons in orbit. To do a human Mars mission, you're talking about 200 or 300 tons in orbit. So one is like a million times larger enterprise than the other. Because, you see, it's much easier to go to a world than to build one. And that is why humans to Mars is a much nearer term prospect. And building colonies and cities on Mars are a much nearer term prospect than building floating cities in space like Gerard O'Neill said. That said, the part where I'm going to ally myself with you to a certain extent is this, is that if we build the transorbital railroad that I discussed.
Oh, yes. Great idea.
Okay. Then if people have ideas like yours, they'll be able to give them a try. It won't just be me saying, I think that's too far in the future. It'll give it a try. If people want to do Mars missions, they'll be able to do it. We don't have to disagree, or we can disagree, but we can disagree in a friendly way because both of us will have the freedom to give our dreams their try. And may the best dream prevail.
Robert, what do you think of the old Star Trek theory of the Federation? You know, not the Europeans, not the Chinese, not the Russians, not the Americans, but a federation. Would that work?
What do you mean? You mean the Federation of Countries of the Earth?
Yeah, in order to just go out into space as a group.
Well, I think that we can certainly do many of these enterprises together with other countries as international cooperation. I don't think that that should be made a condition for doing it. In other words, I don't want to be in a situation where someone says, well, we have to get all the countries to agree before we can go. Okay, but certainly, you know, if we wanted to go to Mars and the French wanted to go to Mars and, you know, the French have a very advanced nuclear industry, you know, 80% of all electricity produced in France is nuclear compared to 20% here. And they say, well, look, you know, we can provide the nuclear reactor. You say, fine, you're welcome. Let's come on. You can give have a member of the crew and bring your stuff and you can be part of the mission. And if some other country, you know, had something to contribute and they wanted to be part of the program, well, sure. And so we can do this together with others who want to work with us. And if there are others who want to do it who don't want to work with us, well, then fine. Let's have an Olympic-style competition, friendly competition to see who can do most to open up the space frontier operating separately. So I think that whether it's people who actually join us in our missions or people who do their own missions, you know, if there's I think this is, in one sense or another, this is a venture for all humanity. and it can be organized a lot of different ways. But I don't think, though, we should make it a condition that we get everyone to agree, because you'll never get that.
Ray is in Gainesville, Florida, and you're on with Robert Zubrin. Go ahead, Ray.
Good morning, George and Robert. Listen, Robert, have you heard of the what is the progress on the space elevator, and also the a launch railroad? Is that what you were talking about when you said the orbital railroad, where they use a maglev system where they accelerate down a track fast enough that it the elevated track shoots a payload into space?
Well, okay. No, although if such a system was available, I'd be all for it. Okay, my transorbital railroad that I'm proposing is simply the government contracting to buy rockets frequently and launch them on a fixed schedule, whether they're fully loaded with payload or not. If they're not fully loaded with payload, we'll load them up with water and food and fuel and just leave cans of that stuff up in orbit available for anyone to salvage and use for their own enterprises. Okay, that's what we'll do with the extra payload capacity on this thing. We'll send up cheap stuff that is nevertheless quite useful in space, and it will be available for use by entrepreneurs or anyone who wants to use it. But it's not, okay, the concept that I'm advancing right now, while it could certainly make use of more advanced technology than what we have now, doesn't need it. We can start this with the kind of stuff we have today, where we just start saying, you know, we're going to buy 12 rockets a year, launch one a month, okay? And if we have paying passengers or paid payloads, fine. If we don't, we'll just fill it with fuel and water and whatever that might be useful at some point in the future and launch that up to orbit instead. Give the launch vehicle industry a guaranteed market, and they start rolling these things off the assembly line. It becomes very cheap for anyone who wants to do something in space to do it, and so on. That's my concept of the transorbital railroad. The as far as more advanced technologies, you know, if they had magnetically assisted launch vehicles, well, that'd be great, okay? And if someone wanted to develop that, they'd have a guaranteed market for their payloads. But we don't need to wait for that. As far as space elevators are concerned, that is the actual cables to space, currently those are not possible. And by not possible, I mean not possible in a considerably more formidable sense than magnetically assisted launch vehicles, which are possible, but we just don't have them, okay? The cable would have to be much, much stronger than any material that we currently know about to make the cable to space concept work. So at this point, that is still speculation. But we can create a transorbital railroad right now with the kind of rockets we have now, just by the government deciding to take a portion of the space shuttle program's money, because the space shuttle program's being shut down for like 60% of the budget of the space shuttle program. We can set up an alternative program here where we just buy these rockets as they come off the assembly line, launch them off to space, make available space on these rockets at basically $100 a kilogram, $50 a pound cost to go to orbit. And then you'll have all kinds of space industries develop, which eventually will pay for this because they'll generate tax revenue, but not at the beginning. At the beginning, we just make it possible for them to get there, for them to start doing their things. If these people who believe in solar power satellites can make that concept work, then we'll have all this solar power from space. If people who believe in space hotels can make that work, we'll have that. You know, if orbital research labs, whatever, if people want to, you know, launch lunar or Mars colonies and attempt to make them prosper, the transportation system will exist to get them there. And, you know, when they built the Transcontinental Railroad, they didn't ask each person what they were going to do once they got to California. They just said, here's a way to get to California. And out of that, we got California. So there you have it.
All right, let's go to Goldsboro, North Carolina. Let's squeeze one more question in before the break. Go ahead, Jeff.
Hello, Robert. Hello, George. Hey. Transorbital railroad is a great idea. Get you out of the chicken and egg problem of getting into low Earth orbit. Have you ever heard of a guy named Lake Mirabeau? He has an idea for a concept called a laser light craft.
Yeah.
And he uses microwave or laser energy beam to a vehicle. And they've actually produced some of these very, very small scale type vehicles, although I'm not sure it's still being funded. And it hasn't been developed, but he worked out of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. And
yeah, I know him.
And okay, what's your idea, what's your thinking about that?
Well, the problem with that, okay, first of all, the physics works.
Right.
Okay. But it's hard to launch anything large that way because the lasers would have to be so big. It's a very difficult proposition. Now, if we're just launching small things, if you're launching micro satellites, that might work. It's even conceivable you could launch small containers with fuel in it to orbit, care packages, as it were, things like that. But to try to launch major payloads that weigh 10 tons or more, you know, something big enough to hold a crew, that's way in the future for that kind of technology.
Robert, you know, as you look at all things space, what do you see today as the most critical issue, something that should be done immediately?
That's an interesting question. Well, as I say, if NASA is going to be productive, I mean, either they have to do something themselves, which means have a definite goal, such as humans to Mars, and organize their efforts around it, or they have to say they're not going to do things themselves, but they're going to make it possible for other people to do things. Okay? In other words, they either have to, if they want to be an exploration agency, then they got to do exploration. If they're not going to do exploration, then they need to, if they're going to be productive, they need to operate as an agency that facilitates other people doing exploration. And so that's the alternative that I'm posing here with the Transorbital Railroad. That is, you know, I'm still for Mars Direct. If I was NASA administrator and I had the ear of the president, that's what I would tell him, that this agency should have a real goal like it had in Apollo and it should be humans to Mars. But if the political class cannot get their minds around the idea of humans to Mars and accepting the risk that involves, because, you know, Kennedy, he took a risk. That program could have failed. They didn't know in advance it was going to work. They believed in the capacity of Americans to take on challenges, and they believed in that in principle without even knowing in advance this is how those challenges were going to be solved. They just said, we know we can do this because we can do anything. But if they're not willing to do that, then let's set up a transorbital railroad where all NASA has to do is launch these rockets once a month as they come off the assembly line, you know, providing compartments for the payloads of various sizes, you know, managing the financing of it, something that they can certainly do. And if they did that, let other people figure out how to.
I think it's a great idea. We'll be back with final questions with Robert Zubrin on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, Richard Lawrence joins us as we'll talk about UFOs and the extraterrestrial message, a classic Coast to Coast show, so make sure you're part of that. When we come back with Robert Zubrin, we'll take final phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. Robert, to take just a few moments here and mention your two websites, the major ones.
There's energyvictory.net and marssociety.org.
Excellent. And you're doing both of them simultaneously still, aren't you?
Yes.
Indiana we go. Indiana, Pennsylvania, that is. Go ahead, Bruce, east of the Rockies. Hi, Bruce.
Yes, it's what I'm going to say is kind of ominous, considering the $600 purchase form. It could work like a credit card once a month, you know, except what if the government had control of that card? I'll take that answer off the air.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
I don't understand the question.
That will be for a different show. Angie, truck driving in Florida, how did that get through? Go ahead, Angie. Take it away.
I'm calling because I want to go back to your fuel question that you had originally. George asked your guest at the first part of the hour about trucking in the industry. I just wanted to give you a little bit of information I just pulled over. But when the price of fuel spikes, most of these trucking companies are under contracts with different people. I'll give you an example. I've got to take the bead pellets. One truck takes it for the labels. One truck takes it for the bottles, and then they take from the bottles the labels and that sort of thing, finally to the manufacturer, where another truck took the oranges to make the juice that's on the back of this truck, and I'm taking this 1,400 miles from Florida to Texas. In that, I get 5 miles to the gallon. At $3 a gallon, it's killing us financially and the trucking companies to just barely float the line. When it goes up, pay attention, because even though these companies are under contract for a year, that sort of thing, as soon as their contract goes up, the price of freight has to go up in order for them to cover the cost, and then you're going to see the price of your juice go up, and that's just juice. So if you want to know, really, we had trucks sitting on the side of the road. We had one company go belly up this last year and had truck drivers sitting all over the country that had to find a way home because the president just went bankrupt.
Up and
left everybody sitting.
Nice guy.
So, yeah. And the difficulty is most people don't realize when you go in and buy something, anything, how many times that item from beginning to end has been on a truck. Even the stuff that comes from China, the raw materials go on a truck, go on a ship, pay for diesel there, and then the ship comes back, goes back on a truck, and then gets back to your manufacturers, to your distributors. So every time that you're consuming anything you touch has been on a truck, Lord knows how many times, and the cost of diesel is in that.
What's the most you can afford, Angie, for diesel? $3, $4? What's the most you could really afford for diesel?
Honestly, the way most contracts are, and if you talk to drivers out here, everybody's making the same per mile that they were making in 1984.
Oh.
So that's the drivers. The drivers have gone from, having tons of money to having to really scrounge to pay their bills, and there's always a shortage of drivers because the minute they get behind the wheel, they get through their schooling, they get through all their regulations, they pay for all their taxes. Every mile that I drive in each state, I pay each state the amount of taxes for that and fuel. I have to pay a heavy highway use tax. By the time I'm done, it takes everything. At the end of the week, we might get a paycheck that reflects 70 hours for myself and my team driver, and we might have made minimum wage for that many hours.
You want to react to that, Robert? Thanks, Angie.
Well,
you're welcome. Thank you.
The fundamental point there is that we all pay for gas in everything that we buy. Even if someone doesn't own a car, they're paying for gas. So like in 2008, when the country paid $1 trillion for oil, divide that by 300 million Americans, that works out to $3,300 a person, man, woman, and child, $13,000 for a family of four. That's what people actually paid for oil. In other words, what you pay for oil is not just what you see when you fill up at the pump. It's part of the price of everything you buy.
Yes, it is. Let's go to Jay, Merrill, Wisconsin, first-time caller. Jay, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
I was just kind of curious if, your guest here keeps on talking about for putting things to the free market and everything. What if we also just made our supplies right out, like with the asteroid belt that's on the other side of Mars, and was able to have unmanned things if they could find out some way to actually produce the materials from the minerals in that, where it could just automatically be doing this on an ongoing basis and producing like sort of the plywood of space or whatever that they could come up with for construction materials that are out there, rather than bringing it all from over here, take it from, well, there's quite a bit of stuff out there.
Well, The philosophy of that is fundamentally correct. In the Mars Direct plan, the way we do a Mars mission is we make our return propellant on Mars out of stuff that's in the Martian atmosphere. And as we proceed in space, we'll want to go further than that. We'll want to grow food out there. We want to make structural materials out there, metals, plastics, wires, tubes, everything. The trick to settling space is to learn how to live off the land.
South Lake Tahoe in California, it's Jim's turn. Go ahead, Jim.
Hi there. Nice to have you pick up my call. Both your topics tonight are very interesting there, Robert, because number one, the flex car idea is a great way to economically get us a little bit less independent from the OPEC gougers. But it kind of leads me with your heavy lift railroad, you know, the atmospheric railroad concept. That leads me to one of the potential businesses that would be available, you know, as competitors with other projects up there, are you familiar with the helium-3 as an energy source on the moon?
Yes.
My question for you is, you know, I've read a lot about it, but I'm not an engineer or a physicist or anything. Is it something that's economically viable if now that we have the heavy lift capabilities through your concept?
Well, it could become so. The helium-3 needs to be used as a fuel in fusion reactors, which mm-hmm. we don't yet have.
Right.
Now, the fusion program has been stalled due to two things. One is lack of funding,
right.
And the other was basically a decision by the U.S. Department of Energy to shut down America's own fusion research program pretty much and just merge to be part of an international program called ITER, which has spent the past 25 years holding meetings deciding where they might put their experiment.
Mm-hmm.
See, that's the problem of being too international. I'm all for collaboration, but you don't want to just liquidate the American effort into some gigantic international mind game.
Yeah.
But if we had fusion reactors, which we could have, then helium-3 is an ideal fuel for them, and it's available on the moon. And if we had cheap transportation to orbit available so that people could readily establish installations on the moon, then this would become potentially a viable kind of business, yes.
Robert, if you got named the transportation secretary tomorrow, what would you do? Where would you start pushing us?
That's an interesting point. Maybe the Department of Transportation can create the transorbital railroad if NASA won't.
Could be.
Yeah.
Could be. Would you push the alternative fuel right away?
Yes. Okay. Yes, I would. This is fundamental to basically the defense of America. I mean, we are being looted by the oil cartel. This is a group of 13 tyrannies, some of which are outright opposed to America, others of which are simply people who don't share our values and don't care about either our future or that of the rest of the world.
Right. Just
and by rigging up the price of oil, they've done incredible damage to the world economy. They've thrown the world into a recession. And by the way, the same kind of price gouging that can send America into recession can send poor countries into starvation. The people who suffer most from this is not us, okay, because, we don't like it, but we could afford to pay $5 a gallon for gas. Imagine if you're a person who makes a dollar a day.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we go to Greencastle, Pennsylvania now. Ray, it's your turn on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Ray.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
I just want to make a comment on your space program. I'm a retired Navy submariner, spent my career on board our ballistic missile submarines, and I've often wondered, and it is for the last 20, 25 years, we have a group of highly trained and highly skilled people in the submarine force who are more than capable of being placed in a space program if you wanted to send anybody to the Mars, to the moon, anywhere. And we're not officers. We don't have to go through NASA or anything. You want us to learn, put us on a space shuttle, give us a year, and we'll be able to operate and maintain that ship as well or better than the engineers who built it. Well,
that's a good
idea.
That's
just a fact.
Plus, you're trained to stay.
And you have all these people available to you.
Well, your point's well taken. I mean, what you have in the submarine force is a group of people who've proven that people can deal with this sort of situation, and in some cases, a much tougher situation than this. And once again, this proves that all this stuff about, oh, how could anyone possibly take being confined in a small craft for 6 months, is just an exaggerated fear. I mean, maybe not everyone can, but there are certainly people who've shown that they can, and we know one place where we could find them, which is the submarine force, yes.
Absolutely. Let's go to Bill, Bloomfield, New Jersey. It's your turn, Bill. Hey, Bill, good morning.
Good morning, George. First of all, I'd like to say that, George, you have, I think, one of the best programs I've ever listened to.
And well, thank you.
You have the most brilliant guests on. I'm just in amazement sometimes. Robert, I've read your book, Energy Victory, and it's one of the best books I've ever read. I keep telling people about it. I push it to, I must have called 100 members of Congress. I tell everyone I see about it, and everybody should get this book. And if I were president, you'd be my energy secretary. I think we would just turn around the whole United States really on a great path. I'm sorry?
How about that, Robert?
Well, that'd be a great thing. The current energy secretary is really more like secretary of research. He's just engaged in funding a bunch of random cool research projects. And the energy advisor in the White House is just wants to try to change the weather. None of these people are thinking of how to actually free this country from the hold of the oil cartel, which really can be done very simply. It's by making the cars not need to run on oil.
Yeah, that's right. I was wondering if you watched the hearings in the House on the energy bill and how they killed the amendment for a flex fuel vehicle in committee. Did you see that?
No, I didn't. You actually saw that happen on TV?
Not only did I see it, I taped it, and I've been sending it to people. I've been trying to get in touch with you, but I just can't seem to do that.
If you go to the Energy Victory website,
yeah,
there's a way to email me there.
Okay.
And you email me there. And we could try to send the file or send me a link or something.
Uh-huh.
And then maybe we can post it up on the Energy Victory site.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds good.
All right.
Yeah, I'll do that.
Okay.
Okay.
Energyvictory.net.
That's it.
Okay.
Great. And we got a link up at coasttocoastam.com. Couple more callers. Let's go to Jim, Lakewood, Florida. You're up on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Jimmy.
Hi, an impulse drive engine will get you to the moon and back in less than a day.
What is an impulse drive engine?
It's something that was, I thought I invented it, but I found out that I didn't. And I saw a picture of it on NASA when they flew up one of their rockets, and they had a ship leaving the Earth. And it was black, and it was traveling a lot faster than that. It's knowledge of way back, hundreds of millions of years ago. It doesn't run on oil. It just runs on a liquid form.
Are you familiar with this at all, Robert?
No, I'm not familiar with this propulsion.
If you want to see it, fly. Take a look at that. Remember when NASA sent up a rocket after that one exploded? You remember when that happened?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. When you look at that picture of that thing flying, you see an object leaving the Earth black. It's about a quarter of an inch long. I mean, we're way out where you can see the whole Earth. It's about a quarter of an inch long, and or probably, I don't know, a fraction or whatever it is wide. It's leaving the Earth, and it goes across behind the rocket and straight out into space. It's like in, you remember the old movies that they used to have, Star Trek and all them?
Mm-hmm.
How it used to go across, and then it would go into space real fast. You can see it if you get it one of those films.
All right. We'll take a look at it. And if you have a copy, send it our way. You never know what's out there, Robert, huh?
Right.
Let's go to Steve in Norfolk, Virginia. Steve, got a minute for you. Go ahead.
Good morning, George and Robert. I have an idea that you make your space shuttles, you take them back up in space, and then use them as tugboats.
Tugboats? What are they?
Move them around. I mean,
well, the problem is the space shuttles are not good for deep space craft because they have all these wings and stuff, which is just a lot of extra weight that doesn't do you any good in space. So the space shuttles are really just for going up and down to orbit.
And unfortunately, they are going to be saying goodbye.
That's right.
They were workhorses, Robert, weren't they?
In their day.
In their day? Absolutely. Great technology in their day. Robert, I want to thank you for being on the program.
All right. My pleasure.
Take care. Robert Zubrin. Couple websites for Robert, MarsSociety.org, EnergyVictory.net. He's got a lot of books out there, but two just home run books, How to Live on Mars, and the other one is Energy Victory. And he's got some pretty novel ideas, doesn't he? And that's one of the things I think we need to do in the future is to come up with innovative ideas like people that Robert Zubrin possess. And you know what? Might make the planet a better place to be. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Ladasur, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.